Уважаемые участники и гости форума.
Dear guests of the forum, we continue the program with the panel discussion World 2050. This session will be moderated by the director of Tsarograd Institute, Alexander Dugin.
Благодарю вас.
Thank you so much. I probably will speak in Russian. You will have headsets.
Try translator in order to be sure.
1, 1, 2, 3, 4. Sound check.
Okay. Вот, коллеги, два слова скажу.
Let me say a couple of words.
Много эмоций, впечатлений.
I do think that we are filled with emotions and knowledge and over those 2 days and yesterday. Minister Lavrov told us about multipolarity. He expressed the official Russia's position, the public one, which was explained more than once by President Putin and by Minister Lavrov as well. And now we have arranged a panel discussion when the representatives of those civilization states that bring about the structure of that nascent multipolar world are present on that stage, except for Africa, but we had Errol Musk from South Africa, so South Africa was present there. At many different conferences, we did it otherwise. So we focused on Latin American civilization, on African civilization, on Islamic civilization. So all the time we're speaking about that. But now it would be very interesting that representatives of those civilizations that are present on that stage and that the majority of the mankind, in essence, we represent the whole of the mankind. Let us think about what their civilizations would look like. Can you describe those images? I suggest that we get away from some cliches and let's just say, how do I see my country in 2050? How do I see my civilization in the world in how many years? 25 years from now, proceeding from multipolarity that we keep speaking about and that we study. Instead, I would like to pass the floor to our remarkable friend from China, professor of Fudan University, Chang Wuwei. He's famous because he was the one who 15 years ago introduced the term of civilization state, adding that to the political lingo. And now it's being used across the globe and many scientific papers have been written with that. And he is director of China Institute. And I met him in Amsterdam during the debates with Antony Blinken and Bernard Levy, the globalists. I was the main opponent and I was defending China. And Chang Wuwei had actually to defend both Russia and China. And certainly he defended China first and Russia second. This is how we made friends, and for many years we are maintaining good relations, good rapport. We don't have much time, so I would ask you to be concise. Leave your further remarks for the second round of Q&A or for some more remarks. Just give us the general outline of that image. Mr. Chang Wuwei, over to you.
When I received this invitation to this Forum of the Future 2050, it reminds me of the Soviet Union. For China, Soviet Union is on the whole a very positive turn. Here, maybe it's slightly controversial because China learned from the Soviet Union, central planning. Of course, we have adapted this to Chinese conditions. It's no longer a company producing how many shoes every year. This we think is not workable. What we have is strategic planning for the direction of the country, say whether you want to go into AI industry, which part of AI industry, you want to do EV, and which part of EV, which technical routes, whatever, experiments, different parts of China, different areas of China, different departments of China, what kind of involvement. So as a result, China today is perhaps most competent in terms of planning and executing its plans. I was in Africa quite a few times in recent years, and they had a saying, they compared the Chinese work in Africa and Western works in Africa. They have a term they call the NATO, which means no action, talk only. NATO. Yeah. And the Chinese one is, we made a commitment and signed agreement. We have it executed yearly ahead of schedule. I'll give you two examples. One is the Green Deal. So much fanfare in Europe in particular. Being politically correct, you have to have the Green Deal, energy transition to renewable energies. But still, in the papers, in China, it's done. 4 5-year plans, 20 years. I challenge the Western model. Can you do that in 20 years with planning, with readjustment every year, every 5 years, in the end, have them executed? Same with German industry 4.0. China was inspired by this German plan. Yet now German plan is in shatters. Yet China has complete its Made in China 2025. Because German industry 4.0 is about intelligence economy. You need to have 5G at least. But Germany followed American Joe Biden's order, ban Huawei products, ban Ali Cloud. But without Huawei 5G technologies, without this Ali Cloud, you cannot have intelligent economy. It's about the connection of everything and no time delay or very, very little time delay. So China has completed German industry. Again, people forget completely. And now we come to this idea of China's plan for the future. When China started to reform 40 years ago, from 78, yeah, 45 years ago, then, you know, Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping said, we need to have a long-term plan, 70 years, roughly by the end of the 2000, and then by the year 2030, and by 2050. Of course, 2050 at that time was a very vague objective. It is said China will become a developed socialist country. No mathematics, no exact whatever. But for the first 20 or so years, from 1980 to 1920, it's very precise. Because China learned its own lessons from the past. At that time, China pursued certain radical programs and failed, including Great Leap Forward. So Deng Xiaoping said we should be more cautious than ever before. But in the end, the performance of China was much better than planned. So by the year 1995, China completed its year for 2000, which means the Chinese economy became four times larger than the level of 1980. And then the Chinese leadership, let's make another plan, more precise one, to the year 2030, from 2000 to 2030. Yet again, China performance was much better than planned. In the end, it's within 7 or 8 years, China fulfilled that objective for the year 2030, which means it's not easy to do really so-called scientific planning based on the current existing conditions. But you need to have a forward-looking, and this object could be slightly loose. So today, China's overall objective still, in official paper, by the year 2050, China will become a socialist developed country. We still use this terminology as before. Yet if you examine the targets China is going to reach, by the year, my own calculation, 2035, China economy will be the economies of both EU and United States put together. Yeah. That's the internal size. And what's also amazing, within China's past 4 and 5 decades, China roughly, because China missed a lot due to historical reasons, missed the first industrial revolution, second industrial revolution, but beginning from 1978, 1980, China roughly accomplished one industrial revolution after another. Every decade, one industrial revolution. Now China is at the cutting edge of new industrial revolution. On the par with the United States, I think slightly better, because we have the most comprehensive industries in the world. United States has been hollowed out with new liberalism. As a result, our AI is connected with each every China's manufacturing as industry, from harbor to mining to whatever. Yeah, so that gives what we call the make AI technology down to us. And then don't forget, China remains a socialist country. We emphasize that. We learned this from Soviet Union, but we have adapt to China's national conditions in the sense that China embraced globalization, but in a critical way. In other words, Chinese philosophy is we try to maximize whatever is good in this whatever existing order, but to minimize whatever is bad in this order. So adopt this, what we call the Marxist philosophy, yeah, or Chinese tradition, Yi Jing. You have both sides, yin and yang, and try to strive for the middle. So as a result, this is, on the whole, successful. I could continue, but I think I should stop. There are so many other speakers. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I
think the future of China in 25 years can be seen today, in today's China, with the level of growth that they are experiencing at this civilization state. They have been demonstrating this, and this is recognized by everyone. There's not a single individual that has doubts about China's future. And they have the ideology, they have the people, they have a powerful economy. It's a great example. Now I would like to ask another individual to speak about their vision of the world. My very good close, Pepe Escobar, a really luminary and author of many books. He lives in many different countries. He's lived in different countries. He is definitely against the liberal hegemony. And I would like to find out what is your vision, dear Pepe, of your native land of Latin America, what its future is entailing.
Thank you, Alexander. But I am a freak in this conversation. I am Brazilian, but I left Brazil a long time ago. And I am a pilgrim. I am probably a descendant of the Scythians, who was born in by accident south of the equator. So my life has been very crazy compared to most normal patterns. The past 40 years, I've been literally all over the world working as a reporter, a journalist, foreign correspondent, editor-at-large, a geopolitical analyst, all that. And basically comparing East and West. I started as a foreign correspondent 40 years ago, exactly this year, in the West, in London. My first post was in London. So the first stretch, it's crazy because I started, for you to have an idea, during the Gorbachev era. I came to the Soviet Union in 1985 on a flight from London, Aeroflot, and then to Japan. That was my first exposure to the Soviet Union. I had been to the Iron Curtain, but it's completely different. So it was an enormous shock for me. And this shock was reproduced in the winter of 1991-92, when I was backpacking in Asia. I took the Trans-Siberian in Beijing, and I arrived in Moscow 2 months after the fall of the Soviet Union. You can imagine this experience for a young journalist. And that's when I decided, after this trip, where I saw China starting to grow, when I went to, especially to Guangdong province, to Shenzhen, to Guangzhou, and then to Shanghai, and then to Beijing, and then comparing to the collapse of my generation, we grew up in the Cold War. So when you arrive in Moscow and you see that's the end of the Cold War and that's the end of the other half of the planet. So that's what drove me to, okay, I have to move to Asia and Eurasia and understand it from the inside. And that's when I first moved to Southeast Asia. Then I start to travel around. I start to go to China quite often. I start to come here at least every few years. And it's something that it doesn't exist anymore. I'm probably one of the last foreign correspondents, as we used to say in the past, where a big newspaper would send a guy to, okay, now you're going to this country and you have to write about this country and discover everything about this country. This doesn't exist anymore. My generation was probably the last. And most of my colleagues, they are either dead or retired in disgust. But what that gave me in my life was to get deeper into especially different cultures and civilization states. It's not by accident, and that brings us to BRICS, and you will understand why I'm talking about it. In 2 weeks, a little over 2 weeks, we're going to have the BRICS summit in Rio, which for me is going to be particularly emotional because I'll be back to the beaches where I used to go when I was a teenager. And I was not thinking about the rest of the world. I was not even thinking about the Cold War at the time. And it's funny because I am a member of one of the BRICS, Brazil, that works very closely inside three other BRICS, Russia, China, and Iran. And I even came up a few weeks ago with a provocative new formulation that what the late, great Yevgeny Primakov in the late 90s called the Primakov Triangle, in fact, which was the embryo of BRICS, was Russia, China, and India. I think now what really applies is the revamped Primakov triangle, Russia, China, and Iran. First of all, three BRICS. Second, they all have interlocked strategic partnerships among the three of them. Third point, the three are an existential threat to the United States. That's very, very important. So for the United States, whoever is in power, these are the three top enemies, with North Korea on the side. And number four, which is the most important, they are the leaders of, let's say, this new incarnation of BRICS, which was solidified here in Russia last year. The amount of work that Russia dedicated to BRICS and to have a successful BRICS summit in Kazan last year was something staggering. Last year, I spent 6 months in Russia, and one of the main reasons is that I wanted to follow closely the preparations for the summit and the seriousness of the British diplomats, Sherpas, specialists, etc., in preparing the summit and opening up, let's say, the real birth of a multinodal, multipolar world. And that brings us to what may happen in a little over 2 weeks from now, after the St. Petersburg Forum. Brazil has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to affirm themselves as a global South leader and at the same time coordinate the roadmap for the next step in international relations, which is the multipolar world. Are they up to the task? I don't think so, unfortunately, and it pains me to recognize that. I grew up in a country, for you to have an idea, I grew up in a country where in 1964, when I was nine, there was a military coup. So we had military dictatorship for almost 20 years, supported by the U.S. all the time. This is my generation. We grew up with that, and we had to put up with that. And that was one of the main reasons for many of us to try to leave. We didn't want to live under military dictatorship, just like the Argentinians in the 70s, or the Uruguayans, or the Chileans after the coup against Allende. When the coup against Allende happened, that was probably one of the first instances of a Latin America solidarity, because the elites in both sides of Latin America, they always split Hispanic Latin America from Brazil. We were in college at the time, and we said, no, we're going to pick up arms and we're going to Santiago to defend Allende. It was the first time that you could see Brazilian students thinking about the rest of Latin America. In our everyday lives, Latin America didn't exist. Just like for many in among the elites in, for instance, in Buenos Aires or in Santiago or even in Montevideo, Brazil was as far away as Nigeria or Senegal. So that was an explicit policy of the comprador elites on both sides of Latin America. It's the Spanish-speaking Latin America and Brazil, which is a continent in itself. It could have been a civilization state, and we could have a gigantic discussion on why it's not, because the potential is there. What Brazil is essentially is a huge melting pot, and that's why it's so fascinating for people around the world. Everybody that goes to Brazil, you can be Swedish, you can be American, you can be Russian. After 1 week, you are Brazilian. And they treat you as a Brazilian, and they treat you like you always lived there. And even if you speak a little bit of Portuguese, only doesn't matter. You are one of them. You are part of the tribe. So the capacity of assimilation of Brazil is something practically unequal. At the same time, this is mixed up with total chaos. It's a supremely anarchic society with virtually no rules. And the worst part is that the tiny elite that we find everywhere, we find in Egypt, we find in Indonesia, we find in Argentina, and we find in Brazil, they profit from that to dominate basically the whole country and everything that matters in the country. And I'm telling you this because this will be reflected in, it is already being reflected in the preparations for the BRICS summit in Rio in early July. And it's what my Brazilian friends are always telling me. Do you know that there is an anti-BRICS lobby at the highest echelons of power in Brazil, even inside ministries? So their masters are fighting against themselves. Just like China can produce successive five-year plans, Brazilians cannot produce a five-hour plan for anything. They are masters of non-management. And in terms of waste, it's incredible. Because of this melting pot and because all sorts of cultures and strands of thought are represented in the Brazilian universe, the country is incredibly dynamic, incredibly creative, but there's no organizing principle because there is not an elite where you can find in China and you can find in Russia with a national project. We are going to be one of the superpowers of the future. Yes, they have everything that it takes to be a superpower of the future, but they don't have a managerial class because they don't have a ruling class that is interested in the country. Their ruling class is interested to go to New York and have a penthouse in Fifth Avenue. And that's the Brazilian tragedy, which is not that dissimilar to the tragedy in other countries in Latin America, but because this is a continental-sized nation, it's much more acute. So let's see if they seize the historical opportunity that they have a few weeks from now during this BRICS summit. Russia paved the way for the BRICS summit in Brazil to be a huge success. Let's see if they up their game and make it a success and open really the new roadmap for the multipolar world. So it's like a football game. We have to be rooting, you know, in the stands like mad, even knowing that defeat could be just around the corner. Thank you.
Благодарю вас.
Thank you very much. And now I would like to
рассказать о своих взглядах.
Ask about their views on the future. I represent for yet another greatest civilizations of the world from one of those poles of today's multipolar world. There are four definite ones, almost ready civilization states: Russia, China, the West, or NATO land, whatever you call it, the North Atlantic civilization, and India, of course. And that's very important. That's definitely a civilization state in all respects. And I would like to give the floor to our dear friend and good guest, a real connoisseur of the Indian identity and the foreign relations, especially in the Southeastern and Southern Asia, Atul Aneja. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much, Professor. India is undergoing a major, major transition right now. And there is a renaissance which is definitely going on in India, because the shift has come in terms of attitude, in terms of self-confidence, but because India has rediscovered tradition and has got this mix of tradition and modernity, in my view, quite correctly. It's remarkable to see the creativity of a Gen Z and the younger generation which we have in places like Hyderabad or in Bangalore, especially the southern part of India, is a powerhouse of talent. And it's coming on into its own. And it's got direction, because we have a clear-cut plan now, but that by 2047, so what, 25 years from now, that we will be a developed country. But I think the biggest thing is the confidence and the self-belief that we can do it. I think that's the major, major change which has come into this new India. We were good in AI, in IT and in services, but I think what's the revolution which is taking place is first in the infrastructure development. Roads, railways, ports, I mean, that's, and cyber, I mean, these are the elements of hard power which are definitely coming in. But I think the biggest revolution which is going to take place, in my view, is in our military industry. I mean, there are software writers, we are doing stuff on our own, which is unimaginable, which is very, very big. And the guidance of that is that we have to be self-reliant on critical technologies, which is getting translated into our defense and military corridors, which are coming up. And that itself is spinning off technology, which is getting channeled into manufacturing. So it's a model which has come in, but along with that is the human side of India, the civilizational side of India. And that is the revolution which has taken place in our pharmaceutical industry. And COVID really showed us that the need just to send paracetamol tablets across nearly 100 countries was important. And we produce it at a very, very cheap price. And I think that is, we call ourselves now the pharmacy of the world. I think that's the way it's going to go in terms of our soft power, in terms of healthcare, in terms of our vaccine development. And the outreach, along with that, to the global south. So there are parallel processes which are going on. One is a creative industrial side of it, and along with this, the soft power area which is going together. We have produced something called the digital public infrastructure, outstanding payment system. Now, I was in China, and China had this outstanding payment system of WeChat and Alipay. But in India, we have 5 or 6 such payment channels, and they are interconnected. So, you know, you can do WeChat to WeChat payment, you can do Alibaba to Alibaba, but you can't do WeChat to Alibaba. In our case, it's all open source, and we do the highest number of digital transactions. So the important thing was, with this digital revolution, also was to include the mass of Indian people into the banking sector as well. how did we fight COVID? I mean, when COVID came and people had no jobs, I think this was what really happened. That through we directly the money was flowing into banks because we exponentially created bank accounts. So those are the kind of revolutions which are taking place in India right now. But I think most importantly is a return to tradition, which I spoke to in the beginning. If you see the CEO of Google today, Sundar Pichai, or you see Satya Nadella of Microsoft, these are boys which have passed out. They're generally from South India and coming out of very, very traditional cultures. You know, the discipline which their tradition gave them. I remember as I was growing up as a student in Bangalore, that I would wake up with the sound of the temple, hymns going on. So that meant that you wake up around 5:36 in the morning, and then you have a complete regime for the day, the amount of time you will spend for your study and your college. And it's a full system of development, self-development, which is there, especially in South India. So I think that's what happens, that they studied in what we call the Indian Institute of Technology. You will not find it very prominently in the Times University list and all, probably about lists around 500 or so. But it has produced some outstanding engineers at a very low cost. And these are the guys who have gone to the US and done so well, because tradition and education, mathematics, STEM came just together in this case. But the point is that while this was not something which was en masse earlier, now that's changed. This has become mainstreamed across our young people. So that's why I'm extremely hopeful about India. We'll have of the rise of India and about our aspiration in 2047. But I have only two on the geopolitical level. We have two main challenges. In fact, three. One is, as we establish ourselves as a pole, there is resistance which is coming. And I would even say that people, I don't think Pepe merely meant it that way, but you know, when you say RIC, there should be Iran, Russia, Iran, China. I think there is an issue there that India is being excluded. I'm wondering, why can't it be RIC? So as we establish, become stronger, there will be resistance which is coming in. I think we need to get our act together with two major other civilizational poles. One is the United States. If people think that we have become an ally of the United States, I don't think they understand India. We will not be ally of anything. We have a strategic autonomy and self-belief and a civilization. We're not going to be a subset of any other civilization. That's absolutely clear, whether it's going to be US. The other important relationship is that with China. It's very, very important that when you talk about the BRICS and the RIC, etc., that India and China learn how to live together. That is going to be a very, very important challenge. And that's why Foreign Minister Lavrov's formulation of RIC is extremely important. We are together. And we rediscover how close we were in our far history. Buddhism went from India to China. In fact, they preserved Buddhism because we had the oral tradition, they had the written, putting it and coding it, everything. So the Chinese preserved Buddhism, which came from India. But that was a relationship which went on for centuries. And if you look at history, it was either China's the number one economy and India's number two economy, or the other way around. We got to have that perspective of when we think of RIC, of what we were, to recover the magic of our history. And I think with Professor Zhang Weiwei here, as a person who understands civilizational states, we need to work this relation around. And if we do that, then the world changes, because we then become the most populous sort of center across in the globe, working together. And then you have Russia on one side. Eurasia is definitely the vehicle which is going to be the driver of the global system. So I think it's very important that these two geopolitical obstacles are out of the way. And then I think there is also a very important internal issue which we have, which is the Indian identity. We have 180 million Muslims in India. And you know, how do we, while we go into tradition, also absorb along with that another tradition? And I think something unique will come out, and we have something to learn here from the Indonesians, the way they have managed the balance of Muslims and Hindus in the Sufi tradition. We need to rediscover that, and most importantly, to make sure that our national identity remains uppermost and our religious identities remain subsets of that or below that. I think I have done enough sort of propaganda for my country. So I leave it here and thank you very much.
Thank you so much. All the civilizations that we're speaking about really are important, and now we discover them from different sides. However, we assess their potential and the speed of their development, whether we look at that with skepticism or with optimism. But nevertheless, now probably the most interesting thing happens in America, because until recently, just 3 to 4 months ago, it was a stronghold of the global evil. So the United States of America was a bad name and a taboo word. And it was the epitome of everything bad, and we were at war with that. And really, America was the global evil. But once Donald Trump came to power, everything has changed. And it is Europe, which looks closer to the image of an satanistic or antichrist civilization, and America now is changing, and the whole world now sees how Donald Trump fights against Elon Musk, and really, that's a very interesting picture. No one of them is a liberal. No one of them is a representative of Joe Biden's administration. They both offer some sudden moves, and neoliberals are just staging color revolutions in LA. They are already in opposition, and they want to stage a color revolution in the United States. And now I pass the floor to a representative of the United States, the famous blogger and journalist and remarkable person who believes that he's Trumpist, although he criticizes many aspects of Donald Trump's policy. And I do think that he is among top bloggers of Charlie Kirk,
Tucker
Carlson, Alec Jones, who sent his welcome address. So he's one of the leading top bloggers, intellectuals. And Jackson Hink will have to speak on behalf of the United States. Tell us what will happen there in 25 years from now.
Hello. Здравствуйте. I'm trying to learn my Russian. Thank you, Professor Dugin, for the very kind intro. You know, I'm an American patriot at heart. My ancestors sailed to the United States on the Mayflower. They fought in the American Revolution. They fought in the War of 1812. They fought in the U.S. Civil War, and they won. They defeated the British. And they served, most of my family served in the Great Patriotic War that was led by the Red Army and won by the Red Army. So, of course, I love the general ethos of Donald Trump and Elon Musk, but there's many things to criticize of these sorts of leaders. Unfortunately, in the United States right now, those who seek true sovereignty for our country, I think, are focused on the wrong things. And it's not that we shouldn't focus at all on these issues of how much money we are sending to USAID or to countries that are waging different wars like Ukraine. Of course, these are things that we must focus on. I talk about them endlessly. But the question of sovereignty doesn't lie in how many hundreds of billions of dollars that we send to Ukraine. The question of sovereignty in the United States is actually much deeper than that even. And it's something that most Americans don't even know about because, of course, our education systems in the United States specifically leave out this information. Someone who has brought this information to the forefront of the public's attention recently is Elon Musk, as well as some very hardcore MAGA Congress people like Thomas Massie, Ron Paul, Rand Paul, for example. These are some of the strongest American patriots that we have. And the question of American sovereignty lies in U.S. debt. And I'll give you a brief analogy. I don't know if anyone here has ever seen The Sopranos, that great TV show from America. But if you have, you know that this mafia crime family led by Tony Soprano was very powerful in New Jersey. And if Tony Soprano happened to lend you $50,000 and you couldn't make him back that payment, Tony Soprano would control your life, and maybe he would end your life. That's just how it was. The United States has a similar problem. And that problem is the fact that half of every single dollar that we pay in taxes goes to paying off interest on the debt that our country owes to the globalist finance capital class, all the creditors of the major investment institutions all across the world. Now, you got to ask yourself, how can a country be sovereign if half of every dollar being paid in taxes is going to a truly unelected mafia of global finance capitalists? It just doesn't make sense. U.S. debt gives the global creditor class complete control over U.S. domestic policy and foreign policy. And that's a very big issue because, as we're now beginning to learn, despite the best intentions of Donald Trump and the best efforts of Donald Trump, he's coming up against some major roadblocks. I think the most major of which was the fight with that ensued over the past few weeks with Elon Musk. And there's much speculation about what led to the exit of Elon Musk from this administration. And it's fun to speculate. But everything that I've read, everything that I've heard from even Elon Musk's own enemies within the administration, like Steve Bannon, is that Elon Musk was fighting a very sincere war against the deep state. He was fighting a very sincere war against the global crediting class. And this is very dangerous. I mean it. When I first spoke, I had Errol Musk on my show, the father of Elon, my new show online a couple weeks ago. And I said, you know, Elon really needs to up his security. I'm sure you all know this, but his life is at danger when he starts playing these sorts of games. And it's a game for the future of our country and really the future of the world, because the sovereignty of America is intrinsic to the sovereignty of every other country. Now, I hope that one day we can have a leader that listens to Elon Musk and listens to Rand Paul, Thomas Massey, Ron Paul, and can actually abolish the debt in America. That would be step one in achieving sovereignty for America. Step 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, I would say, would be massive industrialization policy, ending the Federal Reserve in the United States, having public banking, land reform, and of course, ending U.S. imperialism, which means exiting all of these cancerous warmongering institutions like NATO, for example. Now, the last thing I'll say about the future of U.S. sovereignty is that, well, these ideas are all really good. We can clearly see that even with Donald Trump, someone who is probably the most unbought, uncorrupted individual that we could ever assume, you know, win the presidency in the modern era, you know, we still have a lot of work cut out for ourselves. And Donald Trump, he maybe only has a few years left in office. Maybe he'll change the Constitution a little bit, you know, tinker around with it, and he'll get a third term. Who knows? But the truth of the matter is we have to be willing to look at the conversation of who is going to continue the MAGA movement. Because MAGA, Make America Great Again, is a very unique, partisan, mostly working class-led political movement in America that kind of spawned out of nowhere. It's unique unto modern American political life. And right now, there's a few different people who are vying for leadership over MAGA. Of course, you have the offspring of Donald Trump himself, who are very politically active, and Donald Trump's closest allies. You have Elon Musk, who recently said that he wanted to start an America Party, and he has a lot of support in the United States right now for an idea such as that. And I applaud both of their efforts. But then you have a more nefarious feature of this dark enlightenment, as the foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zahadova, was talking about earlier. And that's the folks at Palantir, Silicon Valley. For the most part, these are individuals who created the entire tech world in the United States. Up until a few years ago, they were all globalist liberals. Most of them are homosexuals, and they all adopt young boys. It's a very odd trend that we seem to notice amongst these Silicon Valley elite. And they have mixed views on foreign policy, but on domestic policy, their goal is to have total surveillance authority over the American public in an effort to control them. And we're seeing that roll out now in these LA riots. Donald Trump is being pressured just directly after Elon Musk is forced out or exited the administration to implement a massive surveillance plan and program led by Palantir, whose first contract was with the CIA. Peter Thiel is pressuring him to do this, to a massive surveillance program over the population protesting in Los Angeles, which I'm not a fan of those protests in LA, but clearly we don't want to have another Patriot Act, which will serve as the further eroding of Americans' rights. So all of this is to be said that I hope for the best. There is a roadmap to true American sovereignty. The question is, how do we get the right leaders in? How do we stop Americans from being propagandized into falling for fakes and frauds? And hopefully we can have more courageous leaders who could otherwise be sailing on a yacht or vacationing and living life with billions and billions of dollars like Elon or Trump could have done, who decide to enter the political foray and run for president and try to fix our country. Thank you.
Thank you. And on that, I would like to ask to pass the floor to the representative of a fair sex, famous Serbian journalist Liliana Smoilovic. Because quite recently I talked to her, we made an interview, we spoke about the Russian idea, that heavenly Russia that we value so much. And Liliana said a very important thing. If Russia is an idea, then we Serbs are also an idea. I like that very much. I agreed with that. So let's speak about that spiritual Serbia, which is very close to our heart from among all the European nations. Liliana, over to you.
Thank you. Actually, when Pep Escobar said that he was a freak here, I meant, no, you're not. I'm the freak here. I'm the only one that's not from a civilization state. But as probably many of you know, we Serbs have the ego of a civilization state. And in our part of the world, I think we are the Balkan civilization state. I'm not going to venture into any prognostication of the next 25 years, because 25 years ago, if you'd asked me where Serbia would be in 2025, I'd have told you, oh, we'll be a member of the European Union. That's what we wanted. We had just deposed Mr. Milosevic, and it was like this bright future. We had only been in, you know, the West had told us, we have nothing against Serbs. We just have something, we just have a problem with Mr. Milosevic. Once you do away with him, we'll be great friends. So it didn't work out that way. And when I now think back, I have to admit that it's really pretty good that it didn't work out that way. And it's really pretty good that we're not now a member of the European Union, because I'd have to, first of all, people like Ursula von der Leyen or Kaya Kallas would be deciding what sources of information I could access and what not. There would be European censorship in Serbia, which is not the case now. And I'd be listening every day, I guess, about how my country needs to prepare for the coming war against Russia. And I guess we wouldn't have celebrated the 9th of May. We would have been probably in Kiev with the people who arrested that little old lady whose family, like mine, had fought in the Second World War with the partisans, and she had wanted to lay flowers at a monument, and she got put in a car and taken away, I suppose, to be arrested. So I'm not going to make any predictions for fear they might come true. Thank you.
Благодарю вас.
Thank you so much.
Я думаю, что все-таки в Сербии все будет.
I still think that Serbia would be okay. So we will win, and then we will liberate Serbia. Liberate that from that nightmare, which is called the European Union. And now, following the logics of our conversation, of our discussion, I'd like to pass the floor to a representative of France of the European Union.
Замечательный аналитик,
a remarkable analyst, a diplomat,
Лоран Мишлон. Тоже живет, наверное, большее время.
I think that most of his time he lives outside France, but rather in China. But nevertheless, he's a Frenchman, and to be a Frenchman, you have to be born in France, and you will remain a Frenchman till your last day. So you'll have to speak on behalf of the European Union. There is no, we don't have any other Frenchman among the panelists.
Thank you, Professor Dugin, for the nice introduction. It's an interesting panel because tonight we have esteemed representatives of the BRICS from Brazil, from Russia, from India, from China, and from South Africa, right to my left, and Serbia, which has one foot in each. Jackson and myself are the the sad representatives of the collective West. And I don't want to give too much. I mean, I don't have a glass ball, you know, to say the future, but I can see a trend and where France is going to be in the next 25 years. And I don't have good news because, first of all, France is not historically not a country that reforms itself. It's a country that is always an extremist country to the point that there's an explosion and a revolution. Now, the revolution itself, does it bring change? That's another conversation. But if you look at the past 7 or 8 years in France, there were the yellow vest movements, and the people were, I mean, there was extreme police brutality against people who are actually not rioters. I mean, the movement was hijacked and became riots, but actually it was people who were from the middle class and were declassed into the poor class, and these people were demonstrating for this, and they were repressed in a terrible way by the French government. Why is it happening? Why can the government turn against its own people in such a brutal way? It's because in France, all over the collective West, we have a problem of the selection of the elites, and the elites that are selected, and I'm not saying that they are elected, I'm saying that they're selected. They are selected because they agreed to keep our countries as vassal states, vassal state of the EU, vassal state of the deep state of the Anglo-American hegemon. If you look at, I mean, the proof of this is that if you look at the relationship between, for instance, France and Russia, the relationship between France and China, it used to be probably some of the best bilateral relations in history. You know, and now who's the three countries in Europe who are doing everything they can to stop the peace process between Russia and Ukraine? It's France, it's Germany, and it's UK. These three countries happen to be also the three countries that are sending warships in the Taiwan Strait. You would wonder, what is France and what is Germany and what is UK doing in the Taiwan Strait, where they are, you know, playing the role of the proxy for the deep state. So, unfortunately, France is not going to be very different in 25 years from now. I mean, unless something unusual happens. But if you have this conversation with French people, they will all tell you they are waiting for a savior from outside of the EU. They are hoping that Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping will come and help, which is now. But the thing is, It's very unlikely because both China and Russia are sovereign states and they don't interfere in the affairs of other states, right? So it's very unlikely that France or EU will be saved by a foreign leader. So we can only wait for a big change. French people, I was really impressed by French people during the Yellow Vest movement. But unfortunately, as we know, the state is getting ready for more police brutality. The same thing is happening as in the US. The social credit system, which they always talk about as if it was in China, actually is being rolled out in Europe right now. And this is why they talk about it in the media all the time, is because they want to portray China as this big dystopic 1984, you know, police state, which is actually not the case. But this is actually happening in Western Europe and in the US. And by doing this, by demonizing China, they say, look, yes, we do have a social credit system in Europe right now, but it's so much worse in China. Yeah. So unfortunately, France and I think EU is not going to be very, very different. It will be probably in a worse state in 25 years from now. And that's all I can say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's an amazing position, but also quite beautiful and very patriotic, to be honest with you. Thank you very much for your intervention. And the last speaker today, but not least, is the representative of South Africa, the representative of yet another continent, another pole of the world. That is François van den Merwe. He is the head of a patriotic Christian organization that protects and defends the rights of Boers and the population of the descendants of the Dutch. And at some point, they needed to protect, well, the Africans needed to be protected from the Dutch, but colonization has given a lot of evil to all peoples around the world, so we shouldn't be forgetting about it. And now things are changing. Now we need to protect the Boers from the evil, and they need to retain themselves and protect themselves as the nation, based on the principles of fairness. The ethnic groups in Africa have suffered from colonization, but thank God, it's good that we never took part in that villainy. We didn't fight for the colonies. We were true to our moral compass, and that's something that pleases me, and I'm sure that that's why the Africans treat Russia with a sympathy, and that's good, and there is no racism in Russia there. We've never had it, but now we need to protect the Boers, the locals. They are the people that found itself in a very difficult situation. François, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So I would just correct it a little bit that we do not see ourselves as colonizers, but as African in the deepest sense. We were the only white tribe to ever really move to Africa, that left the European roots behind, and we see ourselves as totally African. We say we are the last white tribe of Africa. So I would say that the history of the Boer people is defined by our opposition or our wars and struggle against the British. And every time we would go deeper into Africa, they will come and conquer us again. And we created 19 republics, and every time we would do the exploration and settlement of new areas, and they would just come again and take it. And until today, we sit with a very big British influence, globalist influence in South Africa. And I think the pressure on our people, the Boer people, have created, in a sense, a nation state as well, where we were very sanctioned during the old regime, and we were fighting in the Cold War on the border, and many terrorist organizations all around us. So we had to also create a civilization state in South Africa. It has created a sense of some kind of a culture within us, which is still today very prominent or prevalent in our people, where we are excluded from most realms of society, or trying to exclude us. By there is now a new bill being passed to basically eradicate our language from all schools. There's a lot of I think there's 142 race laws against the Boer people in South Africa. Many of them very, very stringent quotas. It's like DEI, but much more radical. But despite all the challenges, we still thrive. Very few white men can become doctors in South Africa, for example. And it is very, very intelligent people, and they just cannot get into these courses. And they have gone overseas to study, and we have overcome all the challenges they have thrown at us economically, culturally. We have, in a sense, created a nation state within South Africa, where we create our own schools, our own banking systems, our own charity institutions to look after the poor, because you get no subsidies from the government if you do not, if you help white people. It is a reality. If you support the Boer people, then but yes, we have created almost in a sense a parallel system, which I believe a nation state can be seen as. And it is a very difficult situation in South Africa. We always say we have to pay twice for everything. We have to pay taxes for the police, but we have to pay for the security companies as well. It is so in many sectors. And it is interesting, South Africa, when we participate here, it's we have a very unique history that we are not really part of the West. We did not really want to participate in the wars of the empire, but we were forced to. And we are in a unique position where we can be, I believe, a bridge between the worlds, hopefully, one day with Christian conservatives from all over the world, where we can be friendly to the Europeans and to the Russians. But what's happening in Europe now is very bad. And I do not know why they can look at us and see what happens if they will go on this road. The demographic change in Europe is very radical. And if you see in South Africa, by the turn of the first century, we were 1 million white people in South Africa and 1 million of the black tribes in South Africa. And in the 100 years since then, in 2011, there was a census, and it was 4.5 million white people and about 62 million black people. So the demographics changed a lot against us. But we got the system that was inherited by the English, colonial possession, actually, and we had to deal with that. We all not always did a good job, of course, but we are moving into a new era of the world, where I believe the Boer people can be once again a great asset to a nation like Russia, who we have a long history with. We fought in the Second World War in Stalingrad, in Leningrad, some of our people, and many Russian volunteers fought with us in the Boer Wars. And I think the morality question of the past of South Africa, we must not be reduced to a system that we had, just like the Russians are many times reduced to Soviets, and that is all the history or everything about the Russians is they are Soviet, and with us it is apartheid. But we are much more than that. We are a good people. We participate in the economy. We stabilize the country, and I believe it's time again for us to be a player in the world, to be someone that works with countries like Russia, with China, with all global powers that work in South Africa, to be a stabilizing force, a leading force in South Africa, and to be, I believe, a good representation of Western civilization at the southern point of Africa, and to secure the interest of countries like Russia. South Africa is, of course, also very strategically late. When Trump spoke about the South African refugee program, he mentioned two other names, and one of them was Greenland and Panama and South Africa. So I think the strategic value of South Africa is not lost on him, and it must not be lost on Russia and the BRICS countries as well. We have very important minerals in South Africa, very minerally rich, but it's not being mined, and so we need but I think people are afraid to invest in South Africa. I think that is where the Boer can come in to be a reassuring asset within South Africa.
Thank you very much. Dear colleagues, we have two video addresses that we need to look at, and then we will complete our forum, a two-day marathon. I would like to say a couple of words before that. Surprisingly, we have more friends than we had thought in the face of the BRICS countries, the Global South countries. We're talking about billions of people that share our point of view on today's world. As we can see also, there are friends like that in France as well, and in America as well. In fact, yes, if we talk about the end to globalization, people that are against the deep state, I think in America they are already in power. Of course, they're going through the first crash test right now in LA, but it's a test nonetheless. So there are forces like this that we can work with and really have the common opinion with. And before I put on the video, well, I'd like to preempt it by saying that this is from Mr. Kimura. He is from Japan. He is from the West, essentially, from the globalist country, but some countries are great. They have the elites that are in their favor, and they make their people turn into monsters. It all depends on that balance of power, but there's always someone who is on the side of the good. And no matter how hard it was for Mr. Kimura to pursue his policy of supporting Russia, you know, asserting positive values and fighting globalism, he is nevertheless making those steps. Let's take a look at his video.
2050年の日本民族と文化を守るために私たちは何をすべきか。尊敬するアレキサンダー・ドゥーギン博士、またこの大会にご出席の親愛なる皆さん、私は日本の愛国者団体一水会を代表して未来の予想について日本の現状と予測をしてみたいと思います。
What should we do by year 2050 to protect Japan's national culture? Dear Dr. Dugin, dear conference participants, on behalf of the Japanese organization Isukai, I would like to speak about the current situation in Japan and forecasts for future. I am chairman of Isukai. My name is Mitsuhiro Kamura. I would like to express my deep gratitude for the opportunity to speak here today. I believe that all of you here are not only observers of international politics, but persons who represent the dignity of civilization and also the heirs to the spirit of human diversity. The world is now standing at major turning point as unipolar globalism comes to an end and we move toward a multipolar world order. We must ask ourselves some questions. What is our nation? What is our culture? And how can we pass it on to next generation? I apologize for not having interpretation. And the last speech will hopefully not be in Serbian. It's from someone who used to be the vice prime minister and headed the Ministry of the Interior of Serbia, a really well-known good friend of Russia. And for that, he is now in a very difficult situation. And if it's in Serbian right now, well, let's see what the beginning is going to be. We'll listen to the beginning then, and we'll be wrapping it up. Okay, please, put it on. Dear friends, I would like to thank the television of Tsarigrad for the opportunity to speak and for the opportunity to learn from you and share with you the experience that we've gathered over all these decades for the right to be independent and stay the way we were and like the ones before us. Well, of course, we don't know what is going to happen. wars had been fought before, of course, in the past, for different reasons. And wars are ongoing, and there will be wars in the future, I'm confident of that. But there will be less of them, and there will be less what we know from, let's say, World War II, the bombings of Yugoslavia in 1998, the wars will last longer, and small countries are going to be pressured. Other countries will be showing their supremacy and dominance. Of course, there will be information wars fought, because this information is going to be skewed, and it will cover greater masses of people, and people will not take this information critically. We'll trust it, and we need to ensure that future generations were capable of critical thinking. For that, man needs to be sure that what they see on social networks, on social media, what they hear, that that is true, that is the truth. And based on the truth, that they would make their own conclusions and build their worldview. It will be hard to explain what the truth is. Because the truth doesn't seem to be as relevant anymore as it used to be, as is the truth about the past. Because right now they are rethinking and revising history. The Russians and the Serbs used to be confident that people that committed crimes, that they would be ashamed for their deeds. But no, unfortunately, they want a revenge now. The world that was built afterwards, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, this world is the result of what happened after the Treaty of Versailles, and it existed only for a few years, as long as the agreements were to the satisfaction of everyone. It was in effect just for a few years, but that world is gone. The world that is being built now is going to be built on the juxtaposition of the great powers, on the conflict of the great powers. So without the use of nuclear forces, it will be mostly information wars that will be fought, similar to the wars that are fought in Serbia now through social media. It's easy to use social media to fan and ignite a war. And you don't need to provide exact information. You just need to, affect the feelings and sentiments of people. And that would affect the cultural identity of our peoples. The use of the internet and the AI and social media will play an important role going forward. That will play an important role in future wars that will be fought going forward.
And this is the impediment for such wars. This is about the people's feelings. This belongs to the nation that shares certain values, the values that determine who we are, and that make us and our generation valuable. Our Serbs and Russians learn from history that the values that made us big still exist. And those values that made us big and great could be passed over to next generations and can serve as the trend for the future. So, the traditional values are key for us, for small nations such as Serbs. This is important for us to keep our freedom to master our own ICT technologies. We do that not just to prove anything to anyone. We do that in order to prevent the abuse of the social media. I hope that the world which is being created would materialize before the big conflict. And I also hope that AI would be used only for good, not for bad, not to destroy the mankind. Thank you. Thank you so much, dear colleagues. And we are finishing our first forum, Future 2015. You know, I want to thank our participants who arrived to attend that session, to attend that forum, having to travel for many thousands of kilometers. But I also appreciate your presence, because those 2 days, I for quite a while didn't see such an attention, such an involvement and engagement in very complex questions that we raised, that we analyzed, that we have considered. And yesterday, after the first day of the conference, we exchanged our views with Konstantin Malafeev, with other participants, and we came to the conclusion that the main discovery, that's you, our attendants, our participants, because you are the ones to build that world, and we will only help you to do that, because you are our main protagonists, you are our heroes. Thank you so much. And I hope that this forum would become regular. See you in a year's time. Thank you so much.